Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Before the Pentagon Papers and WikiLeaks, before Edward Snowden, in fact, before the FBI kept electronic records, there was a landmark theft of classified documents from a small FBI facility in Media, Pennsylvania, that raised concerns about inappropriate surveillance practices on citizens targeted simply for exercising their right to free expression. The burglary happened on March 8, 1971, triggered a massive search for those responsible, and ultimately made millions of Americans take a newly critical look at the scope of federal law enforcement tactics. The burglars were never caught, but in an Independent Lens documentary that airs tonight on KERA Channel 13 television, they tell their stories publicly. Filmmaker Joanna Hamilton directed the documentary 1971, and she joins us now to talk about it. Joanna, welcome to Think.
It's good to be with you.
Given what I learned about this story in the documentary and what a watershed moment it was in terms of shifting American thinking about law enforcement, I was surprised that I hadn't heard of it before. It could just be my oversight, but it does seem like this burglary has not been remembered like other big events.
You're absolutely right. I mean, I think virtually there are very few people who knew about the burglary before the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI, as this group called themselves, revealed themselves publicly. And they did so, as you mentioned, in this film that's airing tonight and in a book that was written by the Washington Post journalist to whom they leaked the documents back in 1971. I think if they had been caught, they would be as infamous, as notorious, as well-known perhaps as Daniel Ellsberg is today. But you're right. As a result, it's the results of the break-in are well known now. The ultimate revelation was, you know, this huge domestic spying operation that we now know to be called COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program. But no one really knew about the break-in, precisely because they'd never been caught.
How did it come about that the people claiming responsibility decided to share their stories first in a book and then also, boy, it's really public when you go on national television?
That's right. You know, I think as Betty Metzger tells it and as they tell it.
She's the journalist.
That's right, the journalist at the Washington Post who wrote the book. It was really an accident. I mean, they were anonymous sources to her for over 20 years. And then two of them revealed themselves to her about 20 years on. It was really, as they say, accidental. But Betty went back to them and they gathered themselves together and decided that they would participate in this book that she started to research a long time ago now. And then, you know, I think over the years, perhaps they contemplated that it might maybe there might be a film at some point. Anyway, I have the great good fortune to have known Betty for a very long time. And over a period of years, she had shared the outline of the story with me. And I thought it was absolutely fascinating. And I urged her to consider a film. And there came a point about 5 years ago now where she phoned me up and she said, you know, are you serious? I said, oh, you know, of course. And at that point, I met with them. And a couple of days later, they gave me access.
So this was an era, Joanna, in which some anti-war activists had been known to be breaking into draft offices to steal records. At the time, of course, there weren't corresponding electronic records, so missing paper meant missing files, full stop.
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. Exactly. And, you know, as you say, there were many, many draft board raids at the time. It was a way to very effectively disrupt the system because, yes, the cards were gone. The system was disrupted. There were no backup files as there would be today in our digital world. Obviously today, you know, such a break-in wouldn't be possible in quite the same way.
What was the public response to those kinds of break-ins and those draft board raids?
You know, I think the public was, America was very divided back then. You know, so I think there was a groundswell of support, you know, for those who opposed the war in Vietnam. And then there was, you know, a huge portion of the population that were, you know, thought that they were, you know, hippies and how dare they interfere with society in this way. I do think it was very divided.
There were some activists, like this physics professor at Haverford College, who wanted their acts of civil disobedience to have a greater impact in damaging the war machine.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, Bill Davidon, who is the leader of the group, I mean, the break-in was his idea. It was really incremental. I think many of them had been active, obviously, in the anti-Vietnam War protest movement, and many of them had started to learn some of the skills that were necessary to break into a draft board. But yes, a couple of them had become very frustrated that the non-violent protests were really not resonating in Washington, and they felt that they needed to step it up a little bit. And then, you know, there's, as we always sort of called it when we were editing the film, there's a little bit of a right angle turn that you have to do. I mean, so it's one thing to break in to a draft board office, and it's one thing to protest the war in Vietnam. I mean, it's obviously a war is one of the biggest things that a government does on a public's behalf. But here they started to surmise, they started to wonder whether the government was actually trying to suppress their right to express this dissent against the war. It's somewhat different. And so they had no proof. You know, FBI files had never been seen in public before. No one really was going to have access. I mean, J. Edgar Hoover really was really very powerful man. And, you know, in theory was subordinate to the Attorney General, but really was, you know, his equal. And as we know now, you know, had files on everyone, and it was a relatively easy matter for him to subdue, you know, dissent against himself. And so it was sort of to this end, it was really a hunch that they had. It was an educated hunch, but it was a hunch nonetheless. So they decided to conduct this break-in. It was really, burglary was really a last resort for them. Even though they had broken into draft board offices, this was very, very different. But as I say, really a last resort to try and provide empirical proof, if you will, of what the government was doing. But they could have broken in and found absolutely nothing. They broke in not knowing what they would find.
All right, we'll talk about that burglary in a minute, but I want to talk about the fact that they were, Bill Davidon and many of the people that he was working with were, you know, they were having civil disobedience, you know, legally exercising their right to demonstrate. And they had this sense that they were being infiltrated, that there were people among them who were maybe FBI plants. Can you talk about some of the things that they noticed about some of the people who would show up in these crowds and behave in rather strange ways?
Right. I mean, as they describe it, you know, there were people who were addressed, you know, in rather obviously, you know, sort of trying to hippies to be, as they
like
call them.
Costume hippies.
Costume hippies, exactly. Trying to grow their hair and beards, you know, longer. But they would sort of invariably mess up because they would wear these wing-tipped shoes, which were mandatory for FBI agents. And so, you know, according to them, were very easy to spot. And yet, you know, some of them were real agent provocateurs. And so it was hard to disprove it in that environment. And you know, people didn't necessarily want to believe. I mean, as they describe it, people felt there was sort of an atmosphere of paranoia. People thought, you know, no, of course we're not being infiltrated by the FBI. You shouldn't believe that. How can you believe that? Don't believe it. And yet, you know, so which is why Bill, you know, as a scientist, really, I think, sought to provide this empirical proof.
So as you get together a team of people who are going to help with something like breaking into an FBI office and stealing literally every file within it, you need to really be able to trust the people you call on.
That's right. Bill really pulled the group together. He worked with people that he had encountered through the draft board break-ins and through the protest movement in general. But you know, you never know. You never know what might happen. And obviously it was a huge risk, a big gamble that they took. Some of the people were on the older side. A couple of them were very, very young. You know, the youngest member of the group was 19. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a couple of the others were, you know, 20 and 21. And, as they describe it, you know, they were really, you know, you're invincible when you're that age. You know, nothing, you know, egregious can ever happen to you. I'm always surprised that the younger members especially managed to keep it a secret, you know, for so many years when they weren't caught.
So you may feel invincible at 19. When you're 29 and have a house full of kids to support, the risks to seem greater.
Absolutely. Two of them were a married couple. And yes, they both took part, and they had three children under the age of 10 at the time. The husband, John Raines, as he describes it, he was more nervous than his wife was. I think that's perhaps because he had partaken in many more protests than his wife had. Bonnie felt that this you know, was going to be, you know, perhaps her singular contribution to the movement. And they thought about it very, very, very carefully. They stayed up late at night discussing, you know, how could it be that they, you know, could potentially jeopardize, you know, their three children's futures. And they spoke to John's brother, and they didn't tell him exactly what they were going to do, but they said that if they did go to prison, that would he look after their children? He agreed. But yes, it was an enormous risk that they took.
How did the group decide on breaking into what was called a resident agency FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania?
Yeah, so back in the day, they there were these small FBI offices that were called resident agencies. They existed all over the country. There were more than 500 of them that serviced smaller towns, rural areas. And so they had scoped out the downtown Philadelphia FBI office and decided against that because that was, you know, guarded, you know, 24 hours a day, had security alarms. It was going to be much too difficult, sort of more like Fort Knox. And literally, as Bill Davidon, the leader, describes it, he opened up the Yellow Pages and discovered that there was this small FBI office in Media, which is a suburb of Philadelphia. So really not far away and really in the sort of heart of university country, you know, surrounded by colleges. And he went to check it out. Several of them from the group went to check it out. Bonnie, most notably, who really went to case it properly. But they immediately, you know, were able to glean that, you know, there were no security alarms. You know, the locks were regular locks. So if they were able to, you know, pick the lock and get in, perhaps they could pull it off.
So you say Bonnie went to case it. She didn't just show up and walk around the building. She went undercover.
That's right. She went in posing as a Swarthmore student. And at that time, the FBI had just decided to hire their first female agents. Prior to that, there had been none. And so she describes it. You know, the agents felt a little flattered. She was writing an article for the Swarthmore Journal and went in and chatted to them, to the agents, and was able to scope the office and, you know, really case it kind of head to toe, room by room. And that certainly that information did prove very helpful later on.
And as of course, after this had all happened, the FBI agents who'd been there realized what must have gone on. But at the time, it doesn't seem they suspected a thing.
That's right. They really didn't suspect a thing at the time. Immediately, you know, after the break-in, Hoover was incensed. You know, the agents in the office put two and two together. Hoover was incensed that they hadn't got her name even when she'd come in for the appointment. Yeah, there's a file that demonstrates that shows that, you know, there's handwriting on this file. And yeah, she was the only one. They put together a sketch of her. She was the only one that they had a sketch of, but they decided sort of critically not to release that sketch to the press, which would never happen today. They were so publicly embarrassed by the release of these files that I think they really, to the end, they really wanted to keep this investigation quiet. I mean, it was one of the largest investigations that the FBI has ever conducted, but you would never know that because they all along sought to keep it very, very quiet.
They chose to do the break-in on the night of a big prize fight between Muhammad Ali and Joe Frazier, knowing that would cause distraction.
That's right. It was really like breaking in the night of the Super Bowl. and it was, you know, that fight itself, you know, epitomized the divisions of the country at the time as well. You know, Joe Frazier was a favorite of, he was from Philadelphia, but a favorite of Nixon, and Muhammad Ali, you know, was the first time he was back in the ring after being, you know, accused of draft dodging. So it was, you know, really just a monumental fight. Everybody was glued to their radio and TVs and in cinemas.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joanna Hamilton. She directed the new independent lens documentary 1971 that airs tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13 television. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joanna Hamilton. She directed the Independent Lens documentary 1971 that airs tonight at 10 on KERA Channel 13 television. It tells the story of a break-in in an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania in 1971 and the fallout in culture and the investigation of illicit FBI spying activities on citizens using their right to dissent. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. Joanna, as you mentioned earlier, and this is so interesting, the team that conducted this break-in really didn't know what they would find, if everything would be on the level and they would have just sort of put themselves at risk for no good reason. As it turns out, what they found was quite damning in terms of the ultimate understanding of FBI surveillance activity.
That's right. I mean, in certain terms, they really hit the jackpot, but they had no idea going in that that would be the case, that this tiny office, you know, in a sleepy suburb of Philadelphia, if you will, would have, you know, all these files. But of course, it being surrounded by colleges, as we were discussing before, it was really kind of a hotbed of activity, of course, that the FBI was watching. And so it's immediately apparent once they, you know, retreat, once they've taken the files, it's immediately apparent to them that the FBI is indeed conducting this massive surveillance across campuses. And there are documents that detail activities in the rest of the country. But what's immediately apparent is certainly in the greater Philadelphia area. They're watching every student organization. There's a directive that they discovered right away that urged agents to step up their interrogations of activists in such a way as to make them believe that there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. So really to foster this atmosphere that people were being watched. And so the atmosphere of paranoia, the sort of sense that the protest movement was being infiltrated, you know, in such a way as that, you know, as we were talking before, that some people felt, you know, are they around? Are they not? Are they watching us? Are they not? They, you know, immediately it was apparent that they were right, that they hadn't risked everything for nothing. And then, you know, they send the documents off to the newspapers, to the Washington Post, and the story sort of takes legs from there.
Yeah, what is so shocking is that the FBI did not, even in those files, try to conceal what it was doing because they had never really been investigated before, right? They assumed that they could just be right out there in all their own internal files because it didn't occur to them that anyone would ever have access to these things.
That's right. Absolutely. I think it was inconceivable to the FBI, to anyone in the FBI, really, certainly to Hoover, that they would be infringed on themselves. You know, I think the FBI had done many black bag jobs, you know, which were these break-ins. And so, you know, here they were, the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI, as they called themselves, doing a black bag job on the FBI. It was all out there. I mean, it was very surprising. It was surprising to the, you know, to the group, this group, you know, who are in the film. Very surprising to them. You know, some of them thought they might find something that indicated that illegal activity was going on. They had no idea of the sort of the lid that they were about to blow off.
So they send photocopies of these documents to, as you mentioned, the Washington Post and I think the New York Times and the L.A. Times. And then these papers have some dilemmas. What do you do with the stuff that is clearly stolen and yet clearly indicates a pattern of law enforcement abuse?
That's right. There are huge discussions that go on inside the Washington Post, certainly. With the New York Times and the LA Times, it's a little more complicated, and we can certainly get into that if you want. What is very clear is when they sent these documents to those three newspapers, to three reporters at those newspapers, Betty Metzger, the journalist at the Post, is the only journalist who received that packet on her desk. The other packages, the one at the New York Times went to a very famous journalist called Tom Wicker, who was a columnist, and what Tom Wicker thinks he did was hand it off to a fellow reporter to say, you know, I'm a columnist. I'm not going to write my column immediately. Perhaps you want to look into this. And that reporter didn't report on it immediately. At the LA Times, it was a different story altogether. Again, a very well-known reporter by the name of Jack Nelson, who was one of the few reporters, if not the only reporter at the time, who was doing any investigative work on intelligence agencies. Back then, it was unheard of, really, for journalists to cover intelligence agencies in the same way that we know it today. So Jack Nelson was someone that J. Edgar Hoover really loathed. He had tried to get him fired from his job at the LA Times. So when they addressed this package to Jack Nelson, that package ended up being, in all likelihood, intercepted in the mailroom at the LA Times, and Jack Nelson never got his package. When Betty went to him years later, he was incensed that he had missed this scoop. But so Betty, you know, receives these documents. The first thing that she needs to do is authenticate them, and as she describes it, that was the easiest thing for her to do because the Justice Department authenticated them immediately and then asked them not to publish them because they would endanger national security. And then there, you know, she continues to write her story throughout the day, but when she hands the story in at 6 p.m. that night, she's told in all likelihood it won't run. Because there have been these discussions going on between Ben Bradley and Catherine Graham, publisher, John Mitchell, the Attorney General, who's now, you know, infamous for his role a couple of years later in Watergate. But John Mitchell, then Attorney General, has been on the phone several times urging them not to publish. And Betty speaks about this extraordinary role that Ben Bradley performed during the course of, you know, that day, and certainly the hours between 6 p.m. and 10 p.m. when they needed to go to press. He persuaded her, ultimately against the advice of the Washington Post legal counsel, to publish, and the story ran the following day on the front page above the fold. And then every other newspaper in the country pretty much followed suit.
How did
and those... so it created a national uproar.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to ask how those conversations at the Washington Post sort of paved the way for blowing the lid off Watergate, a year later?
That's right. I mean, I certainly, you know, we can only surmise, but that, you know, really it might have given Catherine Graham courage. This was the first time that she was being asked to suppress a story by the Nixon administration. And she, you know, up until then had really been, you know, quite friendly with the administration. It wasn't something that was sort of abnormal to her. We like to think that she's kind of got a little courage there.
And the point is made in the film that for a lot of news organizations around the country, this story represented the first time they did any reporting on the FBI or its agents with anything other than almost booster attitude toward the work that they were doing.
That's exactly right. I mean, as I described, Jack Nelson was really the only journalist who had been doing work that was probing and, you know, vaguely negative. And, you know, as a result, he was really in the crosshairs of the FBI himself. But yes, you know, Betty had reported on the protest movement in general. She'd reported on the Catholic left, you know, the Berrigan brothers, and They had known her work prior to being at the Post. She had worked in Philadelphia, the Philadelphia Bulletin, and that's how they knew her. And of course, you know, in the end, the fact that she was lesser known than these other two journalists was a great benefit.
So there was a mention in these documents of something that you alluded to earlier called COINTELPRO. Tell us what that was and why the inclusion of that single word in this pile of documents that folks received ended up being a really important thing.
Right. Well, when Betty, it was in the first trove of papers that they sent to Betty. And at the time, as she describes it, and, you know, subsequently to many other journalists, and then these documents, you know, were really out there in the public domain. And it was a term just simply put on the top of one of these memos, FBI internal memos. It didn't mean anything to anybody, really, until about a year later. You know, and as we discussed, you know, obviously the immediate stories reveal that there is, you know, this domestic spying going on. But it's a year later, Carl Stern, who is NBC's Justice Department reporter, finds himself on the Hill in the Senate, and he is looking for other information that day. He's looking into how the FBI is conducting its, you know, its investigations into anti-Vietnam War protesters. So there's a similar theme here, but he's looking for a document, and a Senate staffer says, you know, hang on a minute, things are a little backed up for the photocopy machine for the document you want, and here's a sheaf of papers, by the way, that might interest you. And this person hands him the sheaf of documents was the media documents. Now, why that person did that, we have no idea. No idea who that person was. But amongst those documents was this same memo that had the COINTELPRO heading. And Carl took a look at it. And what the memo was asking was asking agents in the Philadelphia area to write anonymous letters to campus administrators, urging them to really to sort of step up their harassment of their own individual surveillance of protesters, anti-Vietnam War protesters, and, you know, just campus agitators. And but these were anonymous letters that the FBI agents were writing to these campus administrators. And Carl was a lawyer, and he, you know, knew that the FBI, you know, he was like, what right? You know, it's illegal. It's illegal for FBI agents to do that. And so he takes a closer look at the document and decides to investigate, you know, and he asked around in the Senate, you know, what does this term COINTELPRO mean? Nobody knew. So he decides to investigate. And, you know, over the course of almost a year, he has a back to and fro with the FBI, with the Attorney General. Everyone turns down his requests. And then finally, he sues. He's actually the first journalist to sue under the Freedom of Information Act. You know, prior to that, the FBI had only released documents to friendly journalists, as we've just been discussing, you know, who were prepared to otherwise, you know, stories that were going to impugn someone. But here, Carl sued, and there was a huge battle that ensued once he had filed this lawsuit. You know, the Justice Department didn't think, you know, ultimately that the judge to whom the case was assigned had the right to oversee the intelligence agencies. In the end, it's Robert Bork who decides to not appeal the decision to release four documents. Four documents are released to Carl Stern, and they say, well, this is it. This is all the information we have concerning COINTELPRO. The problem was that one of those documents then, it describes a directive from Hoover in 1968 where agents are encouraged to neutralize and eliminate, expose and disrupt the New Left movement. And he emphasizes that the operations should be carried out in heavy secrecy and they'd be aimed at disrupting the organized activity of those kinds of groups. Now, you know, Carl then looks at the, you know, there are other documents in there. There's another sheaf, a document that describes not one program, COINTELPRO, New Left, but seven total. So there are seven other programs, you know, against the Black Panthers, Ku Klux Klan, various others. And so he's, you know, thinks that, well, these four documents are not all there are, clearly. There are many more programs that exist and that are out there. And so he sues again. And this time, the FBI releases 50,000 pages. And it is through those 50,000 pages that you get the full detail of these operations. And it's now, you know, all the, you know, things that we know the FBI was doing against Martin Luther King, against the civil rights movement, you know, and the Ku Klux Klan as well. I mean, it was really an all-encompassing program that they ran.
For people who don't know how the Freedom of Information Act works, you can ask for what you want, and if there's not an overriding national security reason not to give it, you have to receive your documents, but you have to ask very specifically. So if Carl Stern had not learned of the COINTELPRO program, he wouldn't have been able to say, tell me about all your secret programs, because they wouldn't have had to reveal anything.
That's exactly right. Absolutely. Without knowing the heading COINTELPRO, he wouldn't have known what to ask for. So it was only once he knew that term that he was able to probe for these files. Absolutely.
So 50,000.
You know, I think.
I'm sorry. Please continue.
I was going to say. I mean, the same would apply now. I mean, you know, we didn't know what the term PRISM meant. You know, a couple of years ago.
50,000 pages of documents went back 15 years. There was a lot going on, and this program had begun in 1956 as a defense against like people within the Communist Party that Hoover wanted to keep, J. Edgar Hoover wanted to keep an eye on.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, that's right. So yeah, the program did start, you know, the sort of Reds Under Your Bed, in that sort of very 50s mentality, you know, the House on American Activities. I mean, that was really the sort of state of play at the time, that was the big fear. It was communist Russia and communists in infiltrating the U.S. And then it morphed over time, as these programs often do, especially if they have no oversight and there's you know, they can act absolutely, you know, with free rein. And so, as we now know, you know, come 1971, really, every, you know, if you wrote a letter to the editor, which was, you know, vaguely, you know, questioning the government's activities, you know, J. Edgar Hoover might open a file on you.
How was it that he had such unchecked authority?
You know, I mean, it was really, you know, a different era. I mean, he also, you know, there are a fair amount of dirty tricks that went on as well. I mean, he really was able to quash any form of opposition, and he did so ruthlessly, as we now know. I mean, he did have files on everyone, you know, presidents included. And so I think there was great trepidation to cross him because careers were destroyed, and there really are countless careers that were destroyed by him.
There was a remarkable revelation about the FBI's activity concerning Martin Luther King around the time that he was announced as the recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's right. I mean, they had, you know, been surveilling Martin Luther King for a very long time, you know, since the 50s as well. There was, again, an anonymous letter that was written to Martin Luther King, basically urging him, I mean, the subtext is urging Martin Luther King to commit suicide. Really, this was, the letter was sent to him a little over a month before the Nobel Peace Prize ceremony in Oslo.
Was anyone ever able to put names to these anonymous letters that were sent? Do we know sort of how they were ordered, the ones that were sent to King, the ones that were sent to college administrators being told to really step on the new left arising on their campuses?
No. I mean, it's interesting, you know, when ultimately when the Church Committee hearings are convened and you have the top echelons of the FBI that come to testify, William Sullivan, who was really a top deputy to Hoover, you know, testified very directly and said, you know, it didn't occur to us at the time that we were doing anything wrong. And so, you know, it's quite clear that Sullivan himself might have written some of these letters, including possibly the one that went to Martin Luther King. As to who wrote the those anonymous, you know, the infamous, now infamous document that Carl Stern investigated, it could have been anyone, most likely in D.C. from headquarters, but it could have been anyone.
We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joanna Hamilton. She directed the Independent Lens documentary 1971 that actually airs tonight at 10:30 on KERA Channel 13 television. I misspoke earlier and said 10 o'clock, but it's on at 10:30. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. We'll come back to the conversation in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with filmmaker Joanna Hamilton, whose Independent Lens documentary 1971 airs tonight at 10:30 on KERA Channel 13 television. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Another target, it turns out, Joanna, was women who were getting together in, I guess, like encounter groups to talk about their problems and the potential for equal rights. The FBI did not like that either.
That's right. Somehow, yeah, no one was spared. Absolutely, they infiltrated. It was the era of, you know, women's lib, and they, yeah, it seems that they canvassed the country for groups that were getting together. And again, they detailed that in their files that were later released to Carl Stern and then ultimately to the Church Committee. And while they found nothing nefarious, you know, nobody was about to overthrow the country, they said, you know, that they should really continue their investigations.
So the Church Committee was this Senate committee that was brought to bear in 1975 to look into, I guess, abuses by the FBI. What was the outcome of those hearings?
That's right. I mean, the Church Committee actually was looked at the activities of all the intelligence agencies at that time, which was quite extraordinary. It was unprecedented, actually, and, you know, has never happened really since. I mean, the 9/11 Committee certainly did take a look, but that was for a very specific event. Here, they were looking across the board, and Fritz Schwartz, who is in the film and who was the chief counsel for the Church Committee, says that even though, you know, they looked at the CIA's activities, the NSA, his work that he did with the FBI he considers to be the most important because they found the FBI to be really contravening the Constitution, breaking the law. And so ultimately, you know, they're able to unpack the full history of COINTELPRO. And the net result is the first set of guidelines governing the FBI's behavior. Prior to that, there had been none, which is why they were able to act in the way that we've been talking about for the past, you know, half an hour. They were able to act with absolutely no oversight and with impunity, however they wanted.
What was the effect of all of this, and the Church Committee in particular, on the way average Americans felt about these government agencies that, for the most part, they had been raised to trust?
Right. I mean, I think this era in general, 75, this is, you know, just post-Watergate. It was really kind of a cataclysmic time, and I think that it was really sort of a change in eras. You know, the sort of scales fell from people's eyes, I think. I mean, here was the president who was, you know, found to be, you know, himself colluding in criminal activities. So certainly the Church Committee helped contribute to, you know, these sort of scales falling away, if you will. Ultimately, I mean, I think they felt very good about the sorts of regulations that they put in place. The oversight that then was put in place, you know, Senate and House committees that were, you know, so oversight, you know, in terms of all intelligence agencies, but, you know, regarding the FBI as well, were put in place for the very first time. The FISA court is also a direct result of the Church Committee hearings and their report. And again, you know, obviously that's been in the news again recently. But certainly at the time, it was, you know, a step forward in the sense that oversight, clear oversight, was being established over the FBI.
Back to this team of activists responsible for the break-in. It had to have been a pretty terrifying time as they realized how very much attention their revelations were getting and that the FBI really wanted to solve this thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of them really lay very low. They didn't go anywhere. They didn't change their names, but they were extremely cautious, and they were very aware that there was a massive hunt on for them. There were, you know, 150 agents that were looking for them all throughout Philadelphia. It was very, very obvious. And so they tried to lay as low as they could. But a couple of them were visited by the FBI, had a couple of close calls. But ultimately, you know, they, as they describe it, were able to hide in plain sight. There were so many suspects. And that's perhaps one reason they managed to evade capture. But, yeah, very fortunate. I mean, John Raines was visited in his home by two FBI agents and was asked very directly whether he was involved in the break-in. And he decided to obfuscate. He knew it was a felony to, you know, to lie to a federal official. And so he said, you know, I'm so incensed by these revelations that are coming out in these documents that I'm not even going to answer your question. And they, you know, they took it. They didn't press him, and they left. And his name was subsequently found to have been crossed off the list of suspects. I mean, of the group of eight, seven were suspects in the investigation. Bonnie, the person, you know, as we discussed earlier, who was the only person they had a sketch of, was the only one who wasn't a suspect in the investigation. It's quite extraordinary. Perhaps, again, this goes back to the sort of, the, you know, their observation of women's groups. Perhaps there was a sort of good old-fashioned sexism that had come into play there.
There's also sort of an irony to the fact that it was an era in which the FBI was behaving in such paranoid ways about so many suspects that ultimately it's like finding a needle in a haystack. You have so many people that you don't trust that you can't find the people who have committed the crime.
Very true. Very true. They also, you know, a couple of things happened to sort of thwart the investigation. The day after the break-in, they decided that there was a gentleman by the name of John Peter Grady who was extremely active in all of the draft war break-ins in and around Philadelphia. He was very well known. That they decided that he was responsible for the media break-in. And that sort of led them down this incorrect path. The Citizens Commission, the burglars, had made very deliberately decided not to involve him because they knew that he would be this FBI magnet. Certainly, he was always a magnet of attention. But the FBI decided that it was him, and it led them, you know, it was a complete red herring, but it led them on this incorrect path for years. The other thing that happened was that the agent in the media office, his name was Tom Lewis, he was very severely punished for the break-in. He was immediately suspended without pay for a month. He was then transferred to Atlanta. I mean, it was caused great hardship to him and to his young family. He had young children at the time. And the greatest irony of all is perhaps that the break-in could have been prevented. The fall before the break-in, Tom Lewis had requested an alarm. And the person higher up in the FBI who had declined that request was none other than Mark Felt, future Deep Throat. And so Tom Lewis clearly felt the need for greater enhanced security in his small office. And then subsequently, you know, he was denied that request. And lo and behold, the break-in happens successfully. And then Tom Lewis, who's, you know, one of the people who would have the greatest knowledge of, you know, people who are active in the area, is then suspended and removed completely from the investigation and not consulted at all.
How did John and Bonnie finally tell their kids about what they had done, and what was the response from them?
You know, I think they told their kids finally when they all sort of got to a certain age, you know, perhaps it was 14 or 15. They also told all of them finally, you know, really properly once they had revealed themselves to Betty, which was now about 20 years ago. And I mean, I think they had alluded to it before that, but then they really sat down once they were contemplating participating in this book project of hers. They sat down with them all and let them know. And I think initially they were all a little concerned about them going public now. But it's also, you know, because there was no legal jeopardy for them, nothing had happened. They were able to feel, I think, proud of what their parents had done, that they had taken a stand and stood up for, you know, protection of freedom of speech and for democracy.
Is there a statute of limitations that ran out on this thing? I mean, technically, they still committed a felony. Not technically, they committed a felony that many people believe was justified, but...
Right. I mean, as their lawyer, David Carey's, or the lawyer who would have stepped in if they had been arrested, he's probably the lawyer on the longest no-fee retainer in history. David says, absolutely, there's really no constitutional defense. You can't defend, you know, breaking into an FBI office. Without doubt, it was a felony, and they were well aware of that. The statute on burglary and theft of government property actually was 5 years. Both were 5 years. Mm-hmm. And so that statute ran in 1976, and the case was closed. So that was the biggest indication that nothing would happen. At the time, you know, Hoover would have liked to have charged them with espionage. Now, espionage relates to national security matters, foreign matters. Obviously, everything they leaked was domestic. So they probably would have had a hard time charging them with espionage had they been caught, but it didn't mean that they weren't going to try. Certainly, that's what they levied at Daniel Ellsberg. Daniel Ellsberg did leak the Pentagon Papers, which had to do with foreign matters. But certainly, if they'd been caught, the trial would have been very highly charged. Given the sensitivity of the documents that they leaked. But anyway, I mean, when we were working on the film and the book, you know, we weren't entirely sure how the government would react and if they would react kindly to these people coming out for the very first time. It was really, we were solving like the last remaining mystery from that time, certainly one of. The atmosphere was one of, you know, tending to prosecute whistleblowers. So we were cautious, certainly while we were in production and while Betty was writing her book. But ultimately, the FBI did release a statement saying, you know, we are a different institution today than we were back in the 70s, partly as a result of the revelation from these documents.
Of the members of that activist team who are still alive and who worked with you for the film and worked with Betty for the book, What is their take on more modern government document theft as carried out by, you know, WikiLeaks and by Edward Snowden, that are complicated in maybe different ways than this one was, but ultimately would purport to be trying to do the same thing?
You know, I think certainly with Snowden, they feel that there is a great similarity. And I think, I mean, just in terms of motivation, you know, I would agree that there is a similarity. I mean, they're both motivated by wanting to let the American public know what U.S. intelligence agencies are doing in their name. So there is a sort of an informal kinship that has sort of grown up between them and Snowden. They've spoken out often in his defense. I think they would all like to see him, most of them, certainly, I can't speak for all of them, come back, be able to come back to the United States and not have to serve a long prison term. I think that, you know, they see that, you know, they started a national conversation back in the early 70s that had never happened before, precisely because the FBI was this really impenetrable institution, and the oversight was really negligible. So you weren't able to have these discussions about what was being done in the U.S. public's name. And then the sort of conversation that Snowden started is quite similar. We hadn't had that same conversation since September 11th, and that conversation is ongoing right now in Congress. In fact, they're debating the renewal of the Patriot Act and the USA Freedom Act right now. This week and next.
So we had these important revelations, though, 44 years ago. We're having the same discussions now. Is it your sense that Americans will always need to be on their guard from security agency overreach?
I think so. I mean, I think we all need to be vigilant and we all need to ask questions. And I think that, you know, absolutely, attempt in whatever ways is possible, you know, obviously principally in legal ways, obviously, to hold government accountable. But hope that investigative journalism, you know, has the best, you know, teeth that it can have, and that citizens continue to pose questions to ensure that it is a government of and by the people.
You sound from your voice like you didn't grow up here. I wonder if you have a sense of how the United States compares to other Western democracies with regard to potential overreach of government agencies and inappropriate surveillance.
That's right. No, I'm from the UK originally. And I mean, I've lived here for a very long time now. But yes, you're right. I mean, I think the United Kingdom, I mean, I grew up during the era of the IRA. The United Kingdom certainly, as we know from the Snowden revelations, GCHQ, the British equivalent of NSA, is probably more draconian than the NSA is. So certainly I'm not sitting here suggesting that the US is, the worst perpetrator of any of these sorts of deeds. I think it's on citizens of all countries, really, to remain vigilant. And so that's my hope, that this is really kind of a universal story that can really speak to the world at large. But I'm thrilled that it's airing on PBS, which is really a sort of a national treasure to continue these robust and thorough discussions of these difficult balancing acts.
You can see Joanna Hamilton's film 1971 tonight at 10:30 on KERA Channel 13 television. It's part of the Independent Lens series. Joanna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect produced today's show. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and if you'd like to email the show, the address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.